Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bible 231, October 28th. Yes, it is. All right, we're going to finish up autonomic nervous system and move into special senses today. And you'll have to learn what a special sense is on top of that. So let's get started with autonomic nervous system. But let's review. Next week, third practicum. And on that third practicum, it's going to be labs 7, 8, and 10. Anything in 7, 8, and 10. And then the next lecture exam is on a Monday, November 16th. And how far away is that? One, two and a half weeks. Something like that. These are the chapters that are on that exam. Anybody have a question about the schedule? You're pretty good with the schedule. I better turn some of these lights down. Okay. So that is the schedule. Let's go and look in autonomic nervous system. Oh yeah, autonomic nervous system, and finish that one up. Okay, sounds like there's some questions back there. All right, how many divisions does the autonomic nervous system have? I need a number. Two. Okay, you guys in the back, I'm going to call your names out, and I'm recording and put it online, so beware. So two. What are the names of the divisions? Sympathetic and parasympathetic. Nice. What's the relationship between those two? They're antagonistic to each other. Most of the time they're antagonistic to each other. And maybe we were looking at these effects. So if the parasympathetic is inhibitory, for instance on heart rate, then you automatically know what the effect of the sympathetic nervous system is on heart rate. It speeds it up, right? So if you scroll down over here, you can see sympathetic increased heart rate. And if the sympathetic nervous system inhibits digestion, what can you tell me about the parasympathetic nervous system? It excites or stimulates the digestive system. So you can't tell which one is excitatory or inhibitory. You just know for sure 100% of the time that they're going to be opposite of each other, right? And what you use to guide your understanding of what these various organs are doing under either sympathetic or parasympathetic stimulation is to know how to characterize those two different nervous systems. And the characteristic of the sympathetic nervous system is fight or flight. When you're faced with a life-threatening or strenuous situation, your sympathetic nervous system takes over. Where do we have that on here? It's on here someplace. I don't see it. But fight or flight is sympathetic. And parasympathetic, how would you characterize parasympathetic? Is rest and digest, right? So those two different states. So when you're resting and watching TV, unless it's a really scary movie, your parasympathetic nervous system will take over. If it's a real scary movie, guess what nervous system takes over? Your sympathetic nervous system. Right, characterized by, let's take a look, characterized by increased heart rate, increased respiration, pupil dilation, activation of sweat glands. Right, so when you go out and see a movie and you pay, I don't know, what are we paying for a movie? $15, $20, something like that, pay for parking. Which nervous system would you prefer to have activated? Rest and digest or fight and flight? Okay, probably depends on your mood a little bit, right? But it's usually the sympathetic nervous system. And I'm sure people that produce movies hire physiologists to find out what kind of visceral or sympathetic effects a particular technique in movies produces. And they use those in their movies just to keep their audience awake. And I should consult with those people too. Okay. All right. So that is some of the physiology. Then let's finish up with the anatomy. Oh, so let's look at this slide. Okay, I see two outflow pathways, two motor pathways. One is going to skeletal muscle, the other is going to smooth muscle. And so the top outflow pathway is through an autonomic nervous system. The bottom one is through what we call the somatic nervous system. So when you look at this slide, right here, maybe I'm using the wrong book. This looks strange. But anyway, when you use the somatic motor pathways, how many neurons does it take to get from the central nervous system, which is spinal cord, to skeletal muscle? One, right? And it's nicely myelated. Here's a neuromuscular junction. It's huge. And whenever this motor neuron is excited, then the skeletal muscle is going to contract. It has no other choice. Okay? Now, here is an autonomic outflow pathway. From the central nervous system to smooth muscle, how many neurons does it take? It will always take two, with one exception to that rule. The cell body is in the gray matter, spinal cord, in this particular case, leaves the motor root. What is the motor root? What's a better way of saying motor root of the spinal cord? Which one is this and which one is this? And this is the motor, 100% motor. This is the ventral root, so it comes out the ventral root. And since it takes two neurons to get to the smooth muscle, here is where that synapse is. And there are bunches of nerve cell bodies and dendrites in this area. And you know that we call a bunch of nerve cell bodies and dendrites in the peripheral nervous system, right? We're no longer in central nervous system, peripheral nervous system. What do we call that structure that's loaded with nerve cell bodies and dendrites? That's a ganglion. And since this is an autonomic outflow pathway, that's what we're going to call this thing, right? An autonomic ganglion. And then the postganglionic fiber goes to this smooth muscle. Okay, so what is the effector organ for the somatic nervous system? Skeletal muscle, right? Effector organ. And effector organ always produces what? It produces a response, right? And so the response of this effector organ, which is skeletal muscle, is contraction. That's all it can do. All right, what are the effector organs for the autonomic nervous system? Smooth muscle. I like that. Here's an example of that. Cardiac muscle. One last thing. And glands. Yeah, we went over that. So those are the three effector organs, and those things will produce different responses. Like if it's a muscle contraction, if it's a gland, it will be secretion. In the autonomic nervous system, the preganglionic fiber is myelinated. The postganglionic fiber is not myelinated. Okay, but there's always going to be two, with one exception. Okay, here is a pretty good example of a sympathetic outflow pathway. Here is that preganglionic nerve fiber going to the ganglion where it synapses. And then here is the postganglionic fiber. And what I see on this slide is that this axon splits into many, many, many different axons. And that's a characteristic of a sympathetic nervous system. When the sympathetic nervous system becomes activated, it activates your whole body. It can't just activate one organ at a time, but all organs together. That's what this, all those bifurcations mean. Okay. On the other hand, right, the parasympathetic nervous system, here's the outflow pathway, myelinated preganglionic fiber. Now we're inside the digestive tract, and I see some smooth muscle here. So this is the postganglionic fiber, and it's really short. And if we look, right, it's not branched very much at all. So the parasympathetic nervous system is very discrete. It can go to one organ without another organ being stimulated. The preganglionic fiber is myelinated, just like sympathetic. Postganglionic is not myelinated. But one thing you should notice is that the postganglionic fiber for parasympathetic outflow is microscopically small, because the ganglion is actually inside the effector organ that it's innervating. So it doesn't have to travel very far, unlike the sympathetic nerves. Okay. And so parasympathetic, the postganglionic fiber is very short, the pre is long. It's the opposite for the sympathetic nervous system. Here I see a bunch of neurons leaving the central nervous system, and I see a bunch of neurons leaving through cranial nerves and sacral nerves, and they're going to various organs. And when you see this diagram, the thing that should pop into your mind is either it's going to be the parasympathetic nervous system or sympathetic nervous system, but not both together, that are illustrated here. One or the other is illustrated. And do you have a sense of which one? I think I talked about it a little bit last time. The outflow, that is craniosacral, is only parasympathetic, right? So parasympathetic leads from the brain, and from S2, through S4. So we call this the craniosacral nervous system. Right, so parasympathetic and craniosacral pretty much are synonyms. Right? One has a little bit more of an anatomic designation than the other, but you can use them synonymously. So all of these neurons that we're looking at here are the preganglionic neurons, because the postganglionic are inside the target tissue and microscopically small, which I can just barely see on this slide. So that's a pretty good illustration of parasympathetic. All right, so here I see some nerves not leaving from the cranium, not leaving from the sacral region, but from the thoracic region and just a couple levels of the lumbar region. So could this be outflow from parasympathetic nerves? You say no, because parasympathetic is what? Craniosacral. These nerves belong to the sympathetic nervous system. And so sometimes we call the sympathetic nervous system thoracolumbar. It's the thoracolumbar nervous system. You can use those synonymously. All right, so the preganglionic fibers leave the spinal cord from T1 to L2. They go out the ventral root, and of course, there has to be a ganglion between the spinal cord and the effector organ. And on either side of the spinal cord, there are a chain of ganglia that are all linked together, and they're called the sympathetic chain ganglia. So these nerves enter, and they can synapse right here. So the postganglionic fiber then leaves and goes to its particular effector organ. But every once in a while, right, a nerve gets into the sympathetic chain and passes straight through to a ganglion that's located in a different location. The sympathetic chain ganglia are found on either side of the spinal cord, but the ganglia, the other ganglia, sometimes we call collateral ganglia or prevertebral. Right? The sympathetic chain are what we call paravertebral because they're on either side, but these over here, the collateral ganglia, are located only in front of the vertebral column. And that's why we call these the prevertebral ganglia. And then the postganglionic neuron travels a long way to the effector organ. That's why the postganglionic fiber for sympathetic is really, really long. All right, so the preganglionic fiber you see in a solid line. Okay, so these are all preganglionic fibers. And if there is a nerve that passes straight through the sympathetic chain without synapsing, these nerves are going to be called splanchnic nerves. So a splanchnic nerve is made up of the preganglionic fibers that pass straight through. And that's the only time that you're going to know a splanchnic nerve. You don't have to know the particular names, but you should just at least know that those are splanchnic nerves that are made up of preganglionic fibers. All right, there's only one exception that I want to look at here. And I'm going to take you to the adrenal medulla. We're not really familiar with the adrenal medulla yet, but here are some kidneys. Right? You have these in your back, and sitting right on top of the kidneys are what we call the adrenal glands. And there's a center part that we call the medulla, and you're familiar that the deep part of any organ is the medulla. And what is the superficial part called?
Cortex.
The cortex, right? Well, there's a nerve that goes to the adrenal medulla, and I would like for you to tell me if it's a preganglionic fiber or postganglionic fiber. Look at that. Is this a dotted line or a solid line? That's a solid line. So this is a preganglionic fiber. It hasn't reached the ganglion anywhere yet, right? And it gets there via a splanchnic nerve. When it stimulates the cells of the adrenal medulla, those cells then release epinephrine and norepinephrine, which is a sympathetic signal that gets put into the blood, and once it's in the blood, where does that sympathetic signal go? It goes all over the body wherever blood goes. All right, so again, that just illustrates that when the sympathetic nervous system becomes activated, all the organs in your body, right, become activated by the sympathetic nervous system. And so this is the one exception where there is no postganglionic fiber, the one going to the adrenal medulla. Looking at the sympathetic nervous system still, remember this is the sympathetic chain ganglia. These are the ganglia. They're interconnected because nerves or axons can move from one to another up and down this chain of ganglia. So let's take a look. Here is the first neuron. This is a preganglionic fiber, right? Leaves the ventral root, gets into the spinal nerve. And then here is the white ramus communicante, because these are myelinated axons. Preganglionic axons are myelinated. And here it can synapse on a postganglionic cell. And then usually it re-enters the spinal nerve via this gray ramus communicantes. Or the nerve can get into the sympathetic chain and it can go up a number of levels before it synapses on the postganglionic fiber. And it can even descend a couple levels. And because it's sympathetic nervous system, it can actually do all of those because these neurons are highly branched. They can either ascend, descend, or maybe even just pass straight through to an effector organ. The only exception, this is the one that I was talking about that goes to the adrenal medulla. Here is the preganglionic fiber, leaving the ventral root, going in the white ramus communicantes, passes straight through the sympathetic chain. It doesn't bump into a ganglion anywhere. It goes directly to the adrenal medulla. And there, the adrenal medulla releases epinephrine and norepinephrine. And these are the hormones that are responsible for activating the sympathetic nervous system in various organs. So in this outflow pathway, there is no postganglionic fiber. The cells of the adrenal medulla are kind of acting like the postganglionic fiber, but these cells in the adrenal medulla don't send nerve impulses anywhere. They just immediately release epinephrine and norepinephrine. Another name for epinephrine is adrenaline, right? So I think you've heard of that before. And another name for norepinephrine is noradrenaline, but that's not used very commonly, but adrenaline sure is. Okay, and there you can see the adrenal gland on top of the kidney. All right, let's look at some of these questions right here. All right, how would you describe the difference between the pre- and postganglionic neurons of the sympathetic nervous system? Let's see if we can just make a really nice synopsis. So we want sympathetic nervous system. How would we describe the difference between the preganglionic and postganglionic nerve fiber? Which one's myelinated? Only the preganglionic, not the postganglionic. And what's the neurotransmitter that's released by the preganglionic fiber? That is the signaling compound that moves across the synapse to excite the postganglionic cell, and it is acetylcholine. It's a neurotransmitter because it's released by a neuron and transmits a signal to the postganglionic fiber. Right, so the preganglionic releases acetylcholine. But in the sympathetic nervous system, what is the neurotransmitter that's secreted by the postganglionic fiber? It is norepinephrine, so it's different. So there's a difference between the pre- and post-ganglionic fibers in the sympathetic nervous system that way. The pre is acetylcholine, the post is norepinephrine. Also, the difference is that the pre-ganglionic fiber can be relatively short. Maybe it only has to go to the paravertebral ganglia, which are on either side of the vertebral column. And then the postganglionic fiber has to find its way all the way to the effector organ. So the pre is short, the post is long. And there's probably a question in here. What about the differences between these two fibers in the parasympathetic nervous system? What about the length? Here's the preganglionic fiber. Here's the post. Which one is longer? The pre is a lot longer. Right, and again, the pre is myelinated, the post is not myelinated. And let's look at the neurotransmitter. The neurotransmitter released by the preganglionic fiber within the ganglia is acetylcholine. Here is the postganglionic fiber. It releases neurotransmitter, and what is that? It's acetylcholine as well. All right, so parasympathetic Nervous system uses acetylcholine. Sympathetic uses acetylcholine for the pre and norepinephrine for the post. Two different kinds of neurotransmitters. I don't even think I want to talk about that. So I think I'm done with the autonomic nervous system. Yeah, I'm done. Unless somebody has a question about the autonomic nervous system. All right, let's just recap this. I'm going to take you on just a quick trip. All right, and then you can tell me what nervous system is being activated. All right, so let's pretend that you're at work right now, and you're renting out DVDs. I don't know if there's a store like that anymore, but or VHS tapes. All right, so you're behind the counter checking people out, and it just so happens that nobody is renting DVDs anymore. There's nobody in your store. Right, so there you are in the store, and you're not busy because you don't have any customers. So are you under stress or are you kind of relaxed? Stressed or relaxed? Right, when there's no customers, you don't have to worry about money going anywhere, anybody taking anything. What nervous system is activated when you're relaxed? Your parasympathetic nervous system. Okay, well then you have a really good idea. You say, well, because I'm not doing anything, I'm going to take out my anatomy book and I'm going to study some. I'm going to answer some questions online. All right. So then you start to do that, and then you feel pretty good because you're doing your homework. You're getting paid at the same time to be in the store. And so is that a good feeling or a bad feeling? That's a great feeling, right? Because you know you're going to have fun on the practicum or the next lecture exam. Right, so you can look forward to that. So what nervous system is activated, parasympathetic or sympathetic nervous system? It's still your parasympathetic nervous system, right? Because everything is in control, really nice, you're getting a lot of rewards. Right? And then you look down at your watch and you go, oh wow, look at that, it's 11 o'clock already, I get to go home. Right? And since you didn't have any business, all you have to do is lock the door because there's nothing went in and out of the cash register. Right? There's no mismatch of receipts, so you don't have to put in $20 to make everything come out right. So you're getting ready to leave work, everything's in control, and how do you feel? What nervous system is being activated? Parasympathetic nervous system, because everything is activated. I mean, everything is just fine. All right, so you get to the door, and you step outside the door, you start to lock the door, and then all of a sudden all the lights in the neighborhood go dark. Right? No electricity in the neighborhood, including your store. Right? And you look around and you can't hardly see anything because it's really dark outside. So now what is happening to your autonomic nervous system? Is it still the parasympathetic nervous system that's activated? It is not. It is the sympathetic nervous system, because now you're under a little bit of a stressful situation. And then you say, okay, well, I'm going to go to my car anyway. You lock the door and turn around and then realize that when you parked your car, the parking lot was full. You had to park like two blocks away in the neighborhood someplace and walk to the store. And you go, oh, so I got to walk through a neighborhood that's all pitch black and I'm not really familiar with this neighborhood. And so what nervous system now is being activated? The sympathetic nervous system. Okay, so when the sympathetic nervous system is activated, what happens to your heart rate? It increases. What about pupil dilation? Does it constrict or dilate? Yeah, so it starts to dilate. Heart rate is increased. Respiratory rate increased. Pupil dilation, so that you can see a lot. And when all your skeletal muscles need blood, your heart needs blood, your brain needs blood, guess what the nervous system does to your digestive system? It starts to slow it down, because under those stressful situations, you don't need to be digesting and processing a lot of food that you've eaten. And so what nervous system then, what's the effect of the sympathetic nervous system on the digestive tract? It is inhibitory, right? So it inhibits the digestive system. And so you're thinking about all that as you're walking to your car, and you're starting to relax a little bit, right? And you're still about a half a block away from your car, right? And then all of a sudden you hear something. You hear some footsteps behind you, okay? Now what nervous system is really being activated? The sympathetic nervous system is really activated. Increased heart rate, respiratory rate, pupil dilation. Right, so, and you're probably getting pretty scared, right? And so that's why the sympathetic nervous system is activated. And just when you're about ready to get into your car, then you hear a voice say, "Oh, what are you doing out here so late?" And you realize it's my voice. And then what nervous system is activated? It's the parasympathetic nervous system that gets activated. Okay, well, I didn't want to leave you with your sympathetic nervous system all activated like that, so hopefully you've kind of been back down into balance a little bit, right? And that balance is really the characteristic of the autonomic nervous system. Half is excitatory, half is inhibitory. You can't tell which one is which unless you think of rest and digest and fight and flight. Then it makes sense. The only thing you know for sure is that if one is excitatory, the other is inhibitory, because that is how the nervous system is built, on antagonism. And that antagonism allows for precise control and balance of these various organs, just like your brake pedal and gas pedal give you precise control and balance of where how fast your car is going. Okay, so that's the autonomic nervous system. So you should know, which one is thoracolumbar? Thoracolumbar. Sympathetic. Which one is craniosacral? The parasympathetic. Yep, so they have different outflow pathways. The only thing, another thing you know for sure is that an autonomic outflow pathway requires how many neurons to get to an effector organ? It's always two, with one exception, the one that goes to the adrenal medulla. Right, that's only one. Okay. All right, so now we're going to get into special senses. I think I have some slides on that. All right, well, I want to say something about what a special sense is. We can classify senses into two main categories. There are general senses and special senses. And a general sense comes from a receptor that can be found anywhere in your body or everywhere. For instance, temperature is a general sense, because if we take an ice cube and put it on your earlobe, can you feel it? Yeah. And if I put it on your belly button, can you feel it? Yeah. What about the back of your knee? Can you feel it? Yeah. So you have temperature receptors all over your body, so that's a general sensation. All right. There are other kinds of sensations. Let's take a sugar cube and put that on your earlobe. Can you taste it? No, you can't. Right? That's kind of silly. Put a sugar cube on your belly button. Can you taste it? No, you can. Later. Okay, back of your knee. You can't taste it. You can only taste that sugar cube if you put it on your tongue. Only one location in your body you have receptors. So the sense of taste is what we call a special sense, because it's highly localized to one area on your body. Right, so let's now think of a different kind of sensation and pick up a flashlight and shine a flashlight on your belly button. Can you see it? No. What about the back of your knee? No. Earlobe? No. If you shine it in your eyes, yes. Right? So what about light? Is that a special or general sense? Special. Only because one or two locations. Right? So there are a number of special senses. Taste is one. That's what we call the gustatory sensation. And you can only smell with your nose. You can't smell with your fingertips. And so that's a special sense. That's called olfaction. So we got gustation, olfaction. Vision is one that we talked about. Hearing is another, because you can only hear with your ears. And then inside that temporal bone, very close to your ears where you hear, are two organs that help you maintain equilibrium. There are two equilibrium senses. All right, so there are six altogether. And three of them are in your ears, right? One is in your eye, one's on your tongue, and one is in your nose. So let's talk about the olfactory sense first. And olfaction is the sense of smell, right? All right, so here is, let's look over here first, right? So here's a nice frontal bone, and behind that is the ethmoid bone, and there's a cribriform plate in the ethmoid bone that's on either side of the crista galli, and it's perforated with all kinds of foramina. And let's zoom into this region over here. And so here's one of those olfactory foramina, and I see nerves, right, actually passing through these foramina, because there are nerves in your nasal cavity. And these olfactory nerves have projections coming, and they embed themselves in the mucus, and the mucus is right up against the air that we're breathing. So these neurons here are actually dangling outside your body. They're only protected by mucus. There are receptors on these olfactory cilia that can bind various compounds, and those receptors have a particular shape, and by the shape of an odorant molecule, your brain can tell what it is. So it's based on shape. So when a molecule binds to these olfactory receptor cells, they become activated, and then they send electrical information into this structure that we call the olfactory bulb. And you're going to start to see this in lab this week, the olfactory bulb. And there are nerve impulses that are generated in the olfactory bulb and then transmitted into the brain. And actually, the olfactory bulb is a part of the brain, part of the central nervous system. These axons here are myelinated, although it doesn't show it on this slide, but they're myelinated. And so this is white matter in the central nervous system. What do we call white matter in the central nervous system? We call it a tract. If we have white matter in the peripheral nervous system, we just call it a nerve, right? But since this is in the central nervous system, we call it a tract. So that's how this system works. There are stem cells that can reproduce these neurons, these olfactory neurons, because as you can imagine, since they're sticking just out in the world, they have a really rough life. No matter what we breathe in, these things get exposed to it, and they have a really short lifetime. Right? They only might live about 2 weeks, and then they're replaced by stem cells. And that's kind of uncommon for nerve tissue. Usually neurons don't ever regenerate or replace themselves, but in the nose they do. So that would be kind of interesting to take some of those stem cells from somebody's nose if they have a spinal cord injury that will never heal, and then put those neurons in there so that they can grow and maybe overcome that damage in the spinal cord. That would be interesting if somebody could do that. Right, but then what might be one of the side effects of putting these bipolar cells that were designed for the sense of smell in somebody's back? Well, then maybe they would be able to smell with their back. I'm not sure what some of the complications would be, right? But at least they would have a spinal cord. That would be wonderful. All right, so here are some of the sensations of olfaction. We can smell things that are flowery, right? Etheric, musky, camphorous, sweaty, rotten, stinging, or acid. Well, there could be thousands of different kinds of receptors. Right. And so here are some of the chemical compounds that would stimulate these receptors. Okay, so there are many, many different ways. The sense of gustation. We're going to go back a couple slides. Okay, so there are receptors on the tongue. The receptors in taste buds. And if we look at the surface of the tongue, it's not flat and smooth. It kind of looks velvety. Right, if you stick your tongue out, you see a nice velvety surface. And on that surface, we have taste buds. Let's look over here. Let's zoom way in on the tongue. Here is a taste bud. Here's the nucleus of a cell. Here's the outline of a tastant cell. So these are cells. Here is a pore. That tastant molecules, once they dissolve in saliva, enter the taste bud. So if you see these cells right here, right, are the things that you're looking at on your tongue taste buds? Because what would you need to see a taste bud since you see these cells right here? No matter how hard you look, you wouldn't be able to see these cells. What instrument would you need to see these cells? Yeah, you need a microscope, right? So taste buds are microscopic. You can't see them. But where you find taste buds are on all of these projections that are on the surface of your tongue, and they're called papillae. So a papilla could have thousands of taste buds. All right, so we want to think of the microscopic structure. And there are hairs coming off of these receptor cells, just like for the olfactory system, and there are receptors there. Molecules will bind, change the electrical properties of this receptor cell, which then sends electrical signals to the brain. Okay, these papillae are arranged in different regions on the tongue. There's some that are very big, so these are the circumvallate papillae. Here are the fungiform papillae. They have different kinds of receptors for different kinds of tastes. And sometimes we can actually use a part of our tongue to taste a certain kind of compound. Sweet is usually on the tip of the tongue, right? Something really rotten and sour is more at the base of the tongue over here. But that is highly variable from one person to another person, and it might even be determined a little bit about culture, by culture, how you grow up, what kind of tastes, right, your culture is familiar with, enjoyable and not enjoyable. So what are some of the sensations for gustation? Right? The primary sensations are sweet, like sugar. Sour would be an acid solution. Bitter, an example of that would be quinine, like tonic water. And then salty is a solution, is a sensation, and umami. Umami is a sensation of fulfillment or enjoyment when you eat something. All right, so y'all know what produces a salty sensation. That is table salt, like sodium chloride. Okay, we said sour was acid, sweet is a sugar. What about umami? What the heck is giving you a sense of fulfillment when you eat something? And we usually think, I don't know, it's still under discussion, but we usually think amino acids, all right? And we haven't talked about amino acids, but can anybody tell me what an amino acid could be used for? Protein. It's a building block of proteins. That's right. So when you eat a protein and it starts to break down, right, you get that sense of fulfillment. So there are very few gustatory sensations as opposed to olfaction, which has thousands and thousands and thousands. All right, and based on which of these receptors are stimulated, sends information to the brain, you could tell me in a lot of cases what that particular food was, right, or drink was. All right, so let me give you something that tastes a little bit sweet, okay, and a little bit sour, and a little bit salty, all at the same time. And let's say it's a liquid. Can you ever remember tasting something that's sweet, sour, and salty all at the same time? Maybe. How about a margarita? Has anybody ever had a margarita? It's a drink. It's an adult beverage, right? And there's salt on the rim of the glass that you taste, and it's sweet and sour all at the same time. And I bet we all could diagnose what that fluid is, right? Okay, so that's the sense of taste or gustation, and now we're going to move into vision. Okay. So vision is accomplished by your eyes. And there are some primary structures for vision and some accessory structures for vision. Accessory structures protect that primary structure or help that primary structure do its job. The accessory structures, or some of the accessory structures, are your eyelids, right? So they protect your eyeball. They're called palpebrae. Here's the superior, here's the inferior. And there are eyelashes that line the margins of the palpebrae, and again, they're there for protection. It's an accessory structure. You don't need eyelashes to see anything, but they just protect your eyes. An eyebrow, again, is there for protection, so that when something it falls off your head, right? It brushes up against your face, it will hit an eyebrow, and that's going to start a blink reflex to protect your eye. All right, so eyebrows, eyelids. Okay, if we look a little bit deeper inside the eye or inside the face, all right, so here is the superior palpebrae, here's the inferior, and there are even glands inside the eyelids. Here's a tarsal gland, and here's a tarsal gland down over here. These don't secrete tears, but more of a little bit of an oily solution, and that prevents dehydration. Right? Where tears come from are the lacrimal gland. Here is a nice illustration of a lacrimal gland, and how would you describe the position of the lacrimal gland compared to the eye? And let's just say the eye is right here where the cursor is, right over the pupil. How would you describe to somebody, where do you find that lacrimal gland? Is it superior or inferior?
Superior.
Is it medial or lateral?
Lateral.
Right, so that lacrimal gland is superior and lateral. It secretes tears through these little ducts, and since the lacrimal gland is above the eyeball, then these tears flow down over the eye, and they also move medially, right, so it just flows over, and that washes out bacteria and debris, and it also lubricates the eye. Okay. But they don't stop there, right? They end up in your nose. And they end up in your nose because there are this little area here is called a caruncle, and there are some holes right there that we call lacrimal puncta. And so tears enter there through these lacrimal canaliculi. These are just tiny, tiny little canals that empty into the lacrimal sac. And then tears get into the nasal lacrimal duct and then finally empty into the nasal cavity. So that's the typical pattern of flow. The lacrimal gland is producing tears all the time so that your eye, at least in most people, so your eyes don't dry out. But you don't have tears running down your face all day long because they end up in your nose via the system right here. Okay, if you're really sad and you're crying, well then all the tears that are made by the lacrimal gland can't get through these puncta and into the nasal lacrimal duct, right? They actually flow down your face. But also when you're crying, you might notice, what about your nose? It gets runny, right? Okay, so tears can run out your nose as well. Okay, and those are some accessory structures. Okay, the eyeball can move around inside the orbit because they're skeletal muscles. They're under your control, and they're outside the eye, so we call those extrinsic eye muscles. So here is an eyeball. Sometimes we call that a globe. And I see six skeletal muscles attached to this eyeball. There are some that are straight. I see one here, and I see one here. The straight ones are what we call rectus muscles, and then there are some that curve around the eyeball. There's one underneath, there's one on top. Right, so there's six altogether. And so there's a superior rectus, inferior rectus, a lateral rectus, and then over here I see the medial, and then this is an oblique muscle, so this is the inferior oblique, and then here is the superior oblique muscle. And these are important because it adjusts your eyeball so that light enters the eye and it falls on the proper space of the retina that gives you your best vision. And we got to go look at that. All right, so extrinsic eye muscles are accessory structures. All right, so let's take a look at an eye. There's some extrinsic eye muscles there. Okay. So here we have, this is a transverse section of an eye. Kind of looks like a sagittal section, but it's really a transverse section. And let's talk about some of the layers of the eye first. All right, the outer layer right here is white, and it's, and who's had lab so far? Anybody have lab that's sitting close to me? Yeah. What is this? We call it the sclera. And what is the sclera like? What's the consistency?
Very tough.
Very tough. That's right. It's even tougher than shoe leather. Probably tougher than an eggshell because it's not brittle, right? It's not hard like an eggshell, but almost, right? So this is the sclera. It protects the eye and gives the eyeball a particular shape. As we move over to the anterior pole of the eye, the sclera changes consistency. It gets a lot weaker, and then it also becomes clear so that light can enter the eye. And this is what we call the cornea. The cornea is really part of the sclera, but it's a much, much different kind of tissue, because it allows light to enter. It's not nearly as strong. All right, so the most superficial layer is sclera. The next layer is the choroid. The choroid has blood vessels in it, and blood vessels are necessary, of course, to bring oxygen to cells and nutrients and to get rid of waste products. And so the choroid is there to nourish the deepest layer, which is what we call the retina. All right, so here is the retina, and that describes the wall of the eye, these three layers, sclera, choroid, and retina. The retina should not have any blood vessels in it. I don't see any blood vessels over here in this illustration. okay, in the retina. And that's because the retina contains photoreceptor cells, cells that are responsible for sensing light. And if there's a blood vessel, then there can't be a photoreceptor cell in the same spot, right? It's either a blood vessel or a cell for vision. And that's why we don't have any blood vessels in the retina. They're located in the choroid. Under certain conditions, though, some of these blood vessels in the choroid can start to grow up into the retina. And guess what happens to somebody's vision when blood vessels move out, migrate out of the choroid into the retina? What happens to somebody's vision? Does it get better or worse? Yeah, it gets worse because it's pushing photoreceptor cells away. All right, and so we call that a retinopathy. It's some pathology of the retina. And one way that that happens, and it took a while to figure this out, when there's a premature baby, where do we put a premature baby that's having difficulty breathing and regulating body temperature and maybe fluid balance, all that kind of stuff? We put them in an incubator, which is the proper temperature, right? And since premature babies have a hard time breathing and they need oxygen inside their body, then we increase the concentration of oxygen in the incubator so it's easier to get inside the premature baby, right? So that helps with their breathing, helps with maintaining their brain and their heart. So that's really good. But if there's a high concentration of oxygen in the incubator, that oxygen diffuses through the cornea, diffuses through these other parts of the lens, and it bumps into the choroid, and that stimulates these blood vessels in the choroid to grow toward where that oxygen is coming from, which is the retina. All right? And so, as that little baby grows up, what happens to that little baby? It has vision deficits as a result of that. Right? And so we call that retinopathy of prematurity, when oxygen is stimulated growth of blood vessels into the retina, and that's pretty much irreversible. And it took a long time to figure out why some individuals were going blind or had vision deficits. And then somebody realized, oh, well, these are all premature babies, and maybe it's linked to that, and then they just had to test and test and test and finally figure that out. So now, a physician, right, when there's a premature baby, have to put them in an incubator. The art of knowing medicine, what the oxygen concentration should be. It should be high enough to help the infant, but not so high that it destroys the retina, right? So that's a judgment call. That's what medicine is all about, having the proper judgment. All right, so those are the three layers. There is a lens right here. A lens is important so that it focuses light. If we have just a light bulb and we turn it on, where does that light go? Does it go just to the front? Does it go up? Does it go to the sides if it's just a light bulb? Does it go backwards, or does it just go in one direction? It goes all over the place, right? So when light is coming from an object, it goes all over the place, which means that the light rays are bending apart from each other to get everywhere in the room. So if light is bending apart, if it enters your eye, then that one little spot where light is coming from is going to look very blurry. So in order to take a sharp image, you have to take that light that is bending away and then bend it back together so it just goes to one point when you take a photograph of it, for instance, or when you look at it. And this lens right here has the ability to do that. So when light is diverging, right, this lens has an ability to focus it to a particular point so that it looks nice and sharp. And where should that light be focused on so that an image looks nice and sharp? Which one of these layers have photoreceptor cells? It's the retina, right? So that light has to be focused exactly on the retina, and if it focuses it behind the retina, right, then the light looks blurry. And if it focuses it in front of the retina, then it looks blurry as well. It has to focus exactly on the retina. That's part of the job of the lens right here. Okay, the lens, I see, has some connections. It has some suspensory ligaments attached to it, right? And on the other end of that suspensory ligament, there's a muscle, and that's what we call the ciliary body. The muscle contracts and relaxes, and it changes the thickness of the lens, but also the curvature of the lens. And that's important because as when light comes to us from far away, light is more parallel. When light is coming to you that is close, it's bending more, has more bend to it. So when you're looking at something close, the lens has to have more power to take those light rays that are bending away fast to focus back on the retina. So the lens has to change shape based on the action of the ciliary body. And you can either see far away or close up, but not both at the same time, because the lens can only be one shape at one time. So I tell you what, why don't you take your hand, put it out in front of your face like this, and stare at your fingernails. Concentrate on your fingernails. All right? Just concentrate on your fingernails. What does a background look like? Is it sharp and in focus or blurry?
Blurry.
Yeah, I have like 200 students in here. Okay? Now focus on the background. Right? Don't focus on your fingertip, but kind of look at your fingertip and is it in focus? Is your fingertip in focus when you're looking way in front of you? No, it's not. I see two hands, but they're both right hands. All right, so that process of changing where you're focusing is called accommodation. So I do want you to know that. I'm sure that's on the slide someplace. Ah, yeah. Accommodation. That's due to the action of the ciliary body pulling on this lens, changing its shape or focal length so that you can see things close up and far away. And unfortunately, as we get older, this lens gets stiffer and it doesn't like to bend as much. Right? And so as we get older, we need reading glasses, for instance, to help us focus. And it takes longer to bend. Right? So when you see a really elderly person driving down the street, right, you should just kind of stay away from them, let them drive on the street without hassling them, right, because this is what they're experiencing, and they don't really like to get on the freeway. Because this lens doesn't change shape very fast, right, and you can only see close up or far away at one time, not both, right, just pretend you're an elderly person, and when you're an elderly person, what is like the absolute most important thing that you don't want to get? You don't want to get a traffic ticket, right? Because then you might lose your license and not drive. So you're concerned about your speed, how fast you're going. You don't want to get a speeding ticket. So you're looking at your odometer or speedometer on your dashboard, right? It's nice and in focus, and you're going 35 miles an hour, and you go, oh, okay, far out. I'm not speeding. I'm not going to get a ticket. I'll be able to drive tomorrow. But then there's a thought that comes into your mind. Say you're driving down the 405 and you think, oh, where's my exit? I don't want to miss my exit because I hate being on the freeway. So you look up from the speedometer and you look down the road to see an exit, but everything's blurry and you have to count 1001, 1002. The lens has to change shape. Right now you can see down the road, I see my exit down there. That's fine. Okay, so I won't miss my exit. I can get off the freeway, no problem. I'm relaxed. And then all of a sudden another thought pops into your mind. You know where your exit is. It's far away. But you're still worried about getting a ticket. So now what are you worried about? How fast you're going. So instead of looking down the road, you look at your speedometer once again, which is close to you. It's all blurry, right? Because you're focusing far away from you. The lens has to change shape once again. So like 1001, 1002, the speedometer now becomes in focus. You can see it. So that's really nice. But then you have another thought. Don't miss my exit, right? Because you don't want to be on the freeway. So you look down the freeway and what? It's all blurry. You have to wait. And then you're concerned about, are you speeding again? Go back and forth, but it takes a long time to switch your vision back and forth. So you really have to be kind and gentle with those viejitos out there because you just don't know how they're going to be driving.
Okay. Is your vision somewhat focused in like a middle plane between your speedometer and your exit? Would that like shift the...
I'm sure there's some people that can do that. Both eyes will operate the same way. Some people have two different kinds of prescriptions in different eyes, right? So maybe they would use a contact in one or get LASIK in one eye and not the other. But it's really tough to do that. I don't know of anybody that can really have different prescriptions for different eyes, one eye for reading and one eye for looking far away.
Oh.
Okay? But some people can do that.
I was going more for the, like, say the ultrasound, if they were to keep their focus in a middle point.
Yeah.
Going to the speedometer, it would be a shorter time.
So, yeah, so could you look someplace where close up is not perfectly in focus, or far away not perfectly in focus, but both in focus enough to know what you're doing? That might be a possibility. I've never thought of that. But you probably want to learn how to do that before you get to be 75 or 80. Yeah, okay. All right, so that's the job of the lens. Okay, so what's that function called when it allows you to focus far away or close up? Accommodation, yeah, it's due to the ciliary body and the lens. All right, so you see the curvature on the lens. Do you see curvature of anything else that light has to pass through? Do you see anything else that has curve to it that light passes through? It kind of looks like a lens. Okay, so here is the cornea. It kind of looks like a lens. It has curve, so that means it's going to bend light as well. And as a matter of fact, the cornea is more important in focusing light on the retina than the lens is. The lens can only make these small adjustments for close vision or far away vision, but it's the cornea that does most of the work. So the shape of the cornea has to match up with the length of the eyeball. If the eyeball is too long, the object is going to focus in front of the retina. If the eyeball is too short, then light is going to focus behind it. Right, and then you would need some kind of prescription glasses to bend the light so that it focuses on the retina perfectly. All right, there's a procedure called LASIK that can change the shape of the cornea. And that's a pretty easy procedure because all you have to do is surgerize the cornea. You don't have to dig around deep inside somebody's eye. Right, you don't have to mess around with the lens or the retina, just the cornea. And that's done with a laser called a LASIK procedure. They remove the epithelium from the cornea. This sounds pretty gruesome, right? But they remove the epithelium from the cornea and use a laser to blast away a few of these cells, and it changes the shape or thickness of the cornea so that light now shines nice and focuses nice and perfectly on the retina. And that laser treatment is probably done in less than a second, right? So that's a really nice thing. I'm not sure I recommend that procedure to everybody. Okay, because there are things that can go wrong in that particular procedure, right? And it's not reversible, and that's vision that you're talking about. It's rare that there are complications, but there can be complications. One of the side effects is that it produces artifacts, especially at night in vision. Sometimes people have a really hard time. Other people don't have nearly so much a hard time at night with night vision. There's a lot of glare that can happen. So those are the two things. But for instance, if your vision is so poor that when you get up in the morning that you can't even find your glasses, then LASIK is really great, right? Because it's going to change your life. It will be really, really, really good. Or if you're a professional athlete, like a boxer, and you can't go into the ring with your glasses on, but you can earn a couple $1 million every night by prize fighting, then, you know, LASIK is probably a really good deal. But day in and day out, I'm not so sure it's great. I don't know if it's good for me because I like to wear glasses. And when you wear glasses, you protect your eyes. So if you ride a motorcycle or do mechanical kinds of things around the house or anytime something can flip into your eye, then it's really good to wear eye protection or play racquetball or whatever. Okay. So the cornea, we said, was pretty delicate. It's not thick like the sclera. Right behind the cornea, there is a chamber, and that chamber is filled with a fluid that's a lot like water. So we call that aqueous humor. Humor just means fluid. And so this chamber is in front of the lens, so we call it the anterior segment of the eye. And this anterior segment has two different components to it. Here is the iris that changes the diameter of the pupil. There's an anterior part and a posterior part. Sometimes this part right here in front of the iris is called the anterior segment of the anterior cavity. And then here's the posterior segment of the anterior cavity filled with aqueous humor. And then behind the lens is another cavity, and we call this the posterior. And that's filled with a different kind of fluid. This fluid is like a gelatin or jelly, and it's very viscous, so that's called vitreous humor. It's like jelly or jello. That helps push the retina up against the cornea so it doesn't fall away. And it's also transparent so that it allows light to go through it. All right, so that's kind of a special solution as well. It's not just like water. It's a little bit more sturdy than water. All right, since we have aqueous humor here, if somebody damages their cornea and puts a little hole in there, that aqueous humor is just going to run out because it's just like water. And now you don't have fluid between the iris, right, and the cornea, or between the iris and the lens, or between the lens and the cornea. They can touch each other when that aqueous humor runs out by accident. Right, and it will, different parts of the eye will reproduce that fluid for you. But the terrible thing is that the lens is sticky, and the iris is sticky, and the cornea is sticky. When that fluid runs out, then these structures can touch each other, and they get stuck. They get glued together, right? And if the lens is glued to the iris right here, can it change shape like it is normally does all day long? It can't change shape. What about the iris? What is the iris doing all day long? It's causing pupil constriction, pupil dilation all day long, so it has to move. But if it's glued to the lens, it can't move either, right? And then all of these will get glued to the cornea and change the shape of the cornea, which will then give you blurry vision as well when you change the shape of the cornea. So when there's damage to this anterior cavity right here and you lose aqueous humor, it produces really severe, long-lasting, probably life-lasting, lifelong vision deficits because these things get all stuck together. And that's a really good reason to wear glasses, right? If you do any kind of mechanical work, put a swing set together for your kids or anything like that. All right, there are a lot of, here's a second good reason. The cornea also has a lot of pain receptors. It's loaded with pain receptors, and I've been told that when you damage the cornea, that will give you the most exquisite sense of pain that you can ever experience, which is another good reason to wear glasses, okay? Protect your eyes. And it used to be when people got contact lenses, they put a contact lens over the cornea. They were plastic, and they were impermeable to oxygen. So oxygen couldn't get through them. The cornea is living tissue, and with those contact lenses in, the cornea slowly starts to die, so you can't wear those contact lenses for a long period of time. Like certainly not overnight. If you wake up in the morning wearing a contact lens, then your eyes would just feel like somebody was poking you with a hot stick, right? A burning stick would be really, really terrible. That just kind of illustrates what kind of pain, right, can emanate from the cornea. That pain is so bad that I've only known one person to fall asleep twice with their contact lenses in. Usually the pain is so bad that you would, no matter what, you would never fall asleep with contact lenses in again. Okay. So don't forget about pain. That's another important reason to wear glasses. Okay. All right, so those are the layers. There's the lens. Don't forget the cornea focuses light. Here is the retina. I just want to make a couple more points. Those extrinsic eye muscles move the eyeball around, right or left, up and down, so that when light comes in the eye through the pupil, it falls directly on this spot right here of the retina. This is the best part of the retina. It's called the macula lutea. It gives you your best vision, and there's even a spot on the inside of the macula lutea that's even a little bit better. That's called the fovea centralis. And so we're going to talk about these areas right here when we come back next time. Okay, macula lutea, fovea centralis, and then we got to talk about photoreceptor cells. Here's the sign-in sheet.